This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Four members of a Homeland Security Advisory Council resigned on Monday in protest over the Trump administration's immigration policies. In a letter sent to DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, the members called the practice of separating children from their families morally repugnant. Under the policy enacted by President Trump before he reversed it with an executive order, more than 2,500 kids were separated from their parents. Now, under a court order, the administration has until July 26 to reunite the families. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the post-traumatic stress some of these children are facing as a result of the policy. But first, we turn to David Martin. He's a law professor at University of Virginia and former deputy general counsel of the DHS under President Obama. Until Monday, he was also a member of the Homeland Security Advisory Council under President Trump. David, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks very much.
So tell us a little bit about what the letter said and how you and your colleagues arrived at the decision to resign.
Well, this had been building for a while. There had been concern among many of us who were members of the council since really the first week of the administration about some of the actions taken. And that first week was the travel ban, barring people, attempting to bar people from primarily Muslim countries. Several of us had been talking about our concerns then and had voiced some of it in our contacts with officers of the Department of Homeland Security. The concern built from other actions that were taken. For me personally, the pardon of Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the controversial sheriff from the Phoenix area, that was another event. But the precipitating event was clearly the policy of separating children from their parents as they came across the border.
So I guess the question is, why now? Was there something specific that tipped the scales for you to do this now? This policy has been implemented and then backtracked for a couple of weeks now.
Well, it did start, conversations started right when the policy became apparent. It took a while. There were many of our colleagues, people had different views about the right approach. We wanted to see if others might come along. I believe there still are other members who are thinking about resigning. So yes, it took a while. It took a while to reach agreement on the text of our joint letter. And there were decisions by a couple of us to send separate letters as well.
I guess, and the other question is, now that the four of you have stepped down, are you thinking you can have more of an impact on this administration's policies from outside of the council? Does resigning advance the cause of trying to get families back together?
Well, we hope so. That remains to be seen. Different members of our group had different motivations. Some simply felt that it was clear that there's no way that we are being listened to here on these kinds of important issues. And it wasn't just the child separation issue. It was broader factors of immigration policy generally. But others of us, I'm certainly committed to doing this, to trying to advance changes in whatever way is possible. I've been engaged in this area for several decades. I do a lot of writing. I'm going to try to continue that. And I don't have a lot of optimism of changing the minds of those who are doing this in the White House, but for this issue to remain a live one during these elections and for Congress to get more engaged at whatever point they can.
David, there's a lot of folks watching what's happening and feeling very frustrated by the lack of ability to really stop this or have an impact on it. We're seeing flow charts coming from the administration in terms of how they want to reunite these families. But taking a step back from all of that and all the frustration, you are a constitutional law scholar. How do you think the treatment of these migrants fits into our legal framework in the United States?
Well, as I said in my individual letter, it was quite surprising to me, even with the initial decision to separate families, quite surprising how casual the department seemed to be about keeping track of the relationships in order to reunify them. There's absolutely no legal basis for any kind of permanent separation. It's true that, yes, when someone is arrested and placed in jail awaiting trial, the children can't go with them. And I should say there are occasions when separating a particular child from accompanying adults is appropriate. There are instances of child trafficking that the department encounters. There are situations in which someone who's not the child of the individuals traveling, children have been lent or rented out in a rather abusive way. for people to appear more sympathetic when they show up at the border. So I don't criticize the department for being vigilant and sometimes taking the children away. But even if you're doing that, you need to keep absolutely perfect records so that you can reunite the children later. And there's certainly constitutional values that are implicated by that. Even for people who have just arrived at our borders, we need to treat them with respect. They have rights to sustain their families. And so there's definitely that kind of an element. But even if there were full legal authority for the step that's taken, it's not required by law. It's certainly not required by law to prosecute the individuals in the way that was done. So our main objection was a policy decision, and that's really how we have to wrestle with this as a country. We need different policies for addressing what is a very difficult situation as people arrive from troubled countries in Central America and come to our borders. Not all of them are going to qualify for asylum. We need systems for dealing with that. There are ways of doing that, however. Again, as I emphasized in my letter, there are ways of running an effective asylum adjudication system and an effective immigration enforcement system that are humane, that address the issues, that treat people with respect, but still could be serious about the enforcement objectives that the administration has and that are legitimate.
David Martin was the Deputy General Counsel of the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama. Until Monday, he was also a member of the Homeland Security Advisory Council under President Trump. He, along with three colleagues, resigned this week over the administration's immigration policies. David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Last Friday, Joshua Perry, Deputy Director of Connecticut Legal Services, publicly addressed the case of two migrant children who were separated from their parents earlier this year.
What is critically important to remember is that Connecticut has a 9-year-old and a 14-year-old who were forcibly ripped from their parents. Their situation, like the situation of every vulnerable child, is unique, special, and important, and we need the government and the court to do the right thing.
On the same day, a federal judge in Connecticut announced that the Trump administration's policy violated the constitutional rights of those children. The judge also determined that the two children were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and ordered the government to propose a treatment plan for them. So what would a treatment plan look like, and is it even feasible? Dr. Alan Shapiro is the medical director and co-founder of Terra Firma, an organization that provides medical, mental health, and legal services to newly arrived immigrant children and families.
I have visited three family detention centers over the last few years, including one in Texas a couple of weeks ago. And what we found, and we put this in a paper called The Detention of Immigrant Children, published by Pediatrics, and became a policy statement for the Academy, we found that both medical care was quite inconsistent in the detention centers, but even more egregiously, the mental health services were very inadequate. And we found that children were not comfortable, families were not comfortable speaking to any mental health professionals that were there. And we were really concerned about the way children and their parents were receiving mental health services. They were not properly being screened. They weren't being screened in a formal way. They weren't receiving the proper interventions. And being in detention itself is a stressor, is traumatic for children and families. And so it's really impossible to give proper treatment while you're constantly being traumatized.
And I'm wondering if, you know, I've often heard talk about culturally competent healthcare and mental health care, and I'm sure that's a big stretch to get there from where we are, but can we assume that there are some cultural gaps in between the mental health services providers who probably want to help these children as best as they can and the children themselves who are either not, they're obviously not American citizens, they may not speak the language, they may have fear of these providers, no?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would say the vast majority of families that we have worked with and that I've seen in the detention centers have never had access to mental health services. And now all of a sudden to get them by someone that's not even Spanish speaking or speaking their native language is just a big gap, which is why we say release into the community, not detention. Release into the community while they're waiting to have their case heard allows them to have access to a medical home, to adequate mental health services, to folks that are really trained to work with immigrant populations and can provide immigrant-friendly, competent, trauma-informed care.
So we know that the Trump administration signed an executive order basically undoing his previous policy of zero tolerance that sort of began this whole process of family separation. But now it seems like the administration is trying to at least going in the direction of detaining entire families. Is that better for children, for their entire family to be detained?
Listen, there was nothing more horrible, more inhumane than tearing a child away from their parent. And, you know, we have this construct called toxic stress. Toxic stress is when a person or child is exposed to prolonged stress and the hormones that the body releases when they're stressed, when they're in this very fearful situation. The longer that child is in that situation, the more harm those stress hormones are doing to the body and really affects the whole body, including brain development. And that is what we're so worried about. So children who are in prolonged stress, whether it's from separation or in detention, leads to acute and chronic medical problems. When a child doesn't have a loving caregiver to provide that buffer for them, that's when we start seeing really the bad effects of stress. So I think there's nothing we can really expect children to do. I mean, children will play, children will color, but we saw even in children who were in shelters for very short periods of time, regressive behaviors, bedwetting, hurting themselves. I saw one child chewing on his arm, another child who took his lariat and was pulling it on his neck like he wanted to kill himself. I mean, those were very common signs that we saw in children, really regressive behavior.
We're also seeing some families being reunited, and there have been many videos that come out about these reunions as they're happening. In some instances, they look very happy. In some instances, the children look sort of in a state of shock. Can you tell us a little bit about what you think happens after, at a mental health level for these kids?
So I think it's really important for us to be able to say that what we have seen with child separation is government-sanctioned child endangerment. The American Academy of Pediatrics has even called this child abuse. So when you are removing a child from their family, it is very confusing for that child. And now when they're being reunited, sometimes after weeks, it's just a period of readjustment. It's like, what happened? Why have I been put in this situation? They don't comprehend it. They don't have the cognitive ability, the developmental ability to understand what's happening. So it takes a short period of adjustment to realize, oh, wait, I'm back with my parent. I'm back with the person that is supposed to keep me safe.
Is there the potential for long-term trauma?
Absolutely. And that is what we're most concerned about. Certainly the children that have been separated for a very long time, the longer those children are separated from the parents, the more endangerment we're causing them.
Dr. Alan Shapiro is the co-founder and medical director of Terra Firma. Dr. Shapiro, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
All this week, we've been talking about what makes something American food. And I've been thinking about some of the dishes I grew up with in my own Puerto Rican family. One of my favorite things that comes to mind is something called pasteles. They're so hard to make, and they are so good when they come out right. And here in New York City, there's at least one spot from my childhood that still makes a mean pastel. Casa Adela is a Puerto Rican restaurant in the East Village, right near where I grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Adela Fargas opened it back in 1976, and though she passed away earlier this year, her family is still running the restaurant. So I went to Casa Adela this week to see how the family keeps its Puerto Rican culinary traditions alive. It's a hot July day at 66 Avenue C, and the gold letters on the windows here boast authentic Puerto Rican cuisine since 1976. Inside, it already feels familiar.
I feel like I'm in Puerto Rico with the heat.
Casa Adela is a small sunny spot with just a handful of tables and some huge fans on the floor that try to keep the air moving. You can hear them as I sit down to talk with Maritza Lopez, Adela's daughter-in-law who still works here every day.
She was my mother-in-law. I loved her to death. And Adela was the type of person that even though she had this restaurant, she didn't know how big she was. She was humble. We are authentic Puerto Rican, and we do basic pernil, arroz con gandules, chuletas, chicharrón de pollo. We specialize in our rotisserie chicken and our mofongo.
I have the cookbook, Cocina Criollo. Have you heard of it? It's the Valdeyuhi book.
Yes, I have heard of it.
It's like the original 1950s Puerto Rican cookbook, right? Here at Casa Adela, do you guys use any cookbook, or is it just all the recipes from Adela herself?
No cookbook at all. It's all Adela's. She did it her way, a pinch of this, and everything had to be in exactly her order. But she knew what she was doing.
And as we're chatting, Gadriel Rivera, Maritza's 22-year-old son and Adela's grandson, walks into the restaurant. Maritza waves him over to join us at our corner table, and I asked him how he learned to cook the island's food.
The restaurant was my playground. So it was pretty much, instead of being outside, my grandmother would teach me. You know, she'd be like, if you're not doing anything, come inside, watch. Because she knew that I love to cook. She taught me how to make pasteles. It was so fun because it was like, she taught me how to like wrap them and whatnot, so they're like, they don't fall apart, so it was cool.
There's a lot of young people, maybe your son is not one of them, but I know there's a lot of younger Puerto Ricans who don't know how to make the food that you guys make here because we lost it. We didn't spend enough time, we weren't taught. Like, do you worry that we're gonna lose Puerto Rican culture or a big part of the Puerto Rican culture, which is food, if you know younger people don't start learning how to make it?
Well, that's up to their parents, because I have my kids, I have three, and my daughter cooks it at home. It wasn't perfect, and I'm surprised. She can do rice, she can do beans, she can do pernil. My son loves to cook, so it has to start at home.
How do we keep this going? You guys are going to keep it going because you are family of Adela, but how do the rest of Puerto Ricans keep this tradition of pasteles for Christmas, arroz con gandules, you know, on a Friday, maybe? Like, how do we keep it going?
The culture will never die out, but in the sense of, like, if everybody just, like, takes the time out and, like, even Puerto Ricans, just to look up, you know, even some do. I think there's, like, tutorials on YouTube, since now that everybody's, like, into that website and, you know, looking up things, how to make it, and, like, hands-on, and, you know, so.
I use a combination of two different cookbooks and the internet.
What happened to the old way of asking your mom? I mean, I don't know if she's alive.
I can do that, too. I made a pernil this winter, and it turned out amazing. So my mom was like, I see you're making this pernil, and you're putting it on Facebook, but you didn't invite anybody. Say, because I don't know if it's going to turn out good. So, you know.
The best critics are the ones that know, especially family members. My first white rice, I was so impressed and I was so proud of it, and my mom took it and made a ball out of it and threw it against the wall and said, there's something wrong with this rice. But I learned.
All right. And I will invite mom to the table, I guess, literally.
Making stuff that are hard to make to begin with. So I think you need to step down and do the basic first.
I know.
Okay, so I want to see you doing that capurria then.
Challenge accepted, but you might have to wait about 6 months till I get it right.
She's going on the internet. go ask your mom. I'm sure you get a shortcut. Family members are number one.
Big thanks to Maritza Lopez, Gadriel Rivera, and everyone at Casa Adela for hosting us. And you can see a few photos of our afternoon at Casa Adela at thetakeaway.org. And we're still hearing from you about food in America.
Hi, my name is Jerrica. I'm from Miami, Florida, and my week revolves around cooking, meal planning, grocery shopping, and then Fridays, cooking all day for Shabbat. I love it. My family loves it. And I have 6 mouths to feed, so it's a full-time job.
Hi, this is Cindy from Sparta, New Jersey. 100% Irish. From my grandparents on both my mom's side, they were Catholic, and my dad's side, they were Protestant, who all moved here between, 1917, 1918. Corned beef and cabbage is what they called out-the-back-door food. Not being allowed in a lot of the stores, the meat and veg that were going bad that day were thrown out the back door at the end of the day. And the Irish, they would take them and pickle them in vinegar first and then boil them and eat them. As I got jobs and moved to other areas, my family moved to Western New York State, actually. They never ate that vile stuff again. Lamb stew for us.
Hi, my name is Michal, and I'm calling from Miami. 25-year-old mom with three kids who works full-time. I try to cook, but it tends to be a little bit boring because they really like the same foods over and over. Also, I happen to be an Orthodox Jewish woman. Once a week for Saturday, we have huge Friday night dinner. So that's usually like a big cooking experience, and that's every single week. I do cook a lot, but not as much as I would like to.
My name is Mitch. I'm from Hollywood, Florida. Cooking for me is a form of immediate gratification. You cook it. It smells and tastes great. You eat it. You feel good. It's almost like playing music.
This is Frank from Colorado Springs, Colorado. I would say 90% of the meals I have are made, hunted, and gathered by me or my wife. And, you know, they say your body is a temple, so this is kind of a sacrament. Even though I kind of sometimes treat my body like a tent and have a lot of Cheetos and craft beer, that's okay.
Give us a call. Let us know what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE. For years, there have been struggles over the gentrification of city neighborhoods, but what about the gentrification of food? Food gentrification is a term coined in recent years to describe how once affordable and staple ingredients can become trendy and costly and ultimately out of reach for poorer communities who once depended on them. It's a trend that presents challenges for more than 40 million Americans who live in food insecure households. And it's an issue that our next guest, writer and feminist Mikki Kendall, has reflected on. Mikki, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this idea of food gentrification, when you started tweeting about this a couple years ago, what sort of prompted that word to come from you? What were you thinking about then?
So this is going to sound a little petty, but I had been out to lunch with a friend, and on the menu, they had ham hocks. And it was like a side dish of ham hock, chopped ham hock. It was $8.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody at our table ordered it. And it was like a saucer, like a tea saucer of meat, not even like a full saucer. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, $8? Eight? Are you kidding me? So I had talked about that a little bit. And we always talk about gentrification, its impact on neighborhoods and communities. And I talk a lot about food and access. And so somehow or the other, in the middle of ranting, admittedly, I started to talk about how we've gentrified the ingredients themselves. It's not even just the housing or the schools, or but also the things you can buy in that local grocery store, how much they actually cost, assuming you have a local grocery store.
But I wonder how many people do think about SNAP benefits and food stamp benefits, et cetera, and the struggle that people in low-income neighborhoods in particular have to find food, access food, and just generally to pay for food.
I think about it because for several years after my divorce, I was on food stamps. And I, you know, I was in school and I was working and I'm a veteran, so I got the GI Bill and all of that. But I remember being one of the few people in my neighborhood who could get to the end of the month, right? And on paper, food stamps were the primary source of my food budget. In reality, I was shorting myself on other things to make sure we had groceries. I know intimately how close it can be, how much you have to shop on sales, how important coupons can be, and also how difficult it can be to come up with meals when your budget is X and this costs Y.
Let's talk a little bit about food shaming. How does gentrification of food play into or not play into or influence food shaming when someone is made to feel bad because they pick up something from McDonald's when that's what they can afford?
Well, part of it is that we tend to focus on this idea of clean eating, good food, that kind of a thing, right? And we ignore, for a host of reasons, that the reason you would have lard in the refried beans, for instance, was that lard was cheap and shelf-stable and blah, 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 but also that was another source of protein and nutrients. It may not be a source you're comfortable with. It may not be the healthiest source, but it was absolutely a source that was affordable. But someone will say, well, those people should be eating better and they should be drinking this and they shouldn't be spending that. And what is happening instead is that we ignore all of the other factors to say, well, it must be their diet. We don't talk about what's available in the grocery store in the first place.
And let's be clear, too, that the selection in a lot of grocery stores and corner stores, particularly in urban communities and low-income communities, is very limited.
Absolutely. So you've got, you know, the quarter water and the pizza. If you have the money left over, you maybe get a pickle or some candy, that kind of a thing. That's going to get you through till dinner or maybe your dinner. Well, I could do that with this $2, $2.50, whatever, $3. Or I can buy 4 apples. Hmm. Well, apple a day. Okay, great. Except an apple's calorie content is what? A lot less than the 800,000 or so you might get from the pizza and the quarter water.
And you also mentioned money. That's such an important part of this because when we think about Chinese takeout, right, or Mexican taco trucks, we tend to value the food. We don't tend to value the people who cook the food, especially at that level.
Because there's a weird, and I'm going to say pioneer, urban pioneer is a phrase I've seen lately, right? This idea that somehow you've discovered Korean food, you've discovered Mexican food, you've discovered soul food. And if you were really about, oh, let's share this food with my friends and empower this community, you wouldn't feel the need to repackage it and sell it yourself. You would start directing people to that wonderful place or trying to invest in that business so that business has a broader reach, right? But what's being seen is, oh, there's profit to be made and I don't need to bring those people along because they might damage my profit. And then on top of that, we undervalue certain types of cuisine as a result, right? So we will think that these multi-step, multi-layered meals, well, that shouldn't cost more than because the person serving it doesn't look to our mind like the color or the gender of the person who should be making a lot of money, who should be a celebrity often, right? We've seen a lot of soul food. I'm picking on soul food. We've seen a lot of elevation of soul food and what's authentic soul food arguments between people who have no connection in any way, shape, or form to that cultural tradition, but they think they have a right to some level of ownership over it. If we're going to talk about who creates authentic soul food recipes, grandma and grandpa do.
What are some of the consequences, sort of circling back to living in low-income communities here and seeing your food being gentrified and maybe seeing the Whole Foods, maybe not in your immediate community, but close enough? What are some of the consequences to the gentrification of food for lower-income families, families who are food insecure?
Well, one of the things is that because you can't afford those staple ingredients for the handful of healthy home-cooked meals, right? When we see the price go up for the collard greens, for the oxtails, for whatever, you're left with what you can afford. X costs too much, so I'm going to have to settle for Y as a decision we've all made at some point in our lives. So then you are no longer feeling that cultural connection with other members of your community even, because those foods don't just exist as, oh, this is a thing I put in my mouth to fuel me. That's community, that's family weekends, that's Sundays, that's your memories that you can no longer access in the same way.
Mickey Kendall is a writer and feminist, and she's currently working on a book called Hood Feminism. Mickey, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
At the top of the hour, I talked to David Martin, one of four officials to lead the Department of Homeland Security Advisory Council in protest of the Trump administration's practice of separating migrant families at the border. But it's not just high-ranking members of government taking action.
We are grannies on a mission.
Across the country, a movement of grandmothers, Grannies Respond, and they also go by Abuelas Responden, is coming together to organize a caravan from New York to the U.S.-Mexico border with rallies planned at stops along the way. The caravan will leave New York at the end of this month, and two of those grannies join me now, Michelle Clifton and Rafia Jones. Michelle, Rafia, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Greetings.
All right, Grandma. So tell us a little bit about yourselves and how you became involved in the movement, Michelle.
Well, I am a granny. I have two wonderful grandchildren. And I was at a concert. My daughter-in-law sings in a concert that was to raise money for a not-for-profit And one of her friends came up to me and said, would you be a granny and drive to Texas, to the border of Texas and Mexico, to be part of a protest? And before that, when I had heard that families were being separated, that babies and children were being taken away from their parents, I was just horrified. And I thought, what can I do as an individual to do something about this? And I thought, okay, I can donate money, and I've done that. And I thought, I've got to do something else. And it was literally within a week that when I went to this concert that Dan Imar Blair came up to me and said, would you be a granny and ride on this bus? And I said, yes. And so then it got started. And it's only, I mean, this is like a month ago. And it's just literally been a movement that has just started with grannies all across the country.
Rafia, how about you?
I have a friend from Seattle, Washington. We used to live there together, and we recently reconnected. And she called me several days after and said, I don't know if you want to do this or not, but I just want to tell you what I'm up to. And she told me about Grannies Respond. And in my heart, I'd been looking for a way to respond that really had more substance to it, I guess. And I said, yeah, I'll get involved. I'm not sure to what extent or how far I can go, but definitely count me in.
And so you'll be also going on the caravan, huh, Rafia?
I'm going to be joining the caravan at some point. Life isn't giving me this option to do the entire week, but I certainly have to be part of that energy force going south.
So, Michelle, tell us about the route. Where does the caravan start? We mentioned in New York. Where is it going? How many stops are you guys thinking of making along the way?
Well, first, we're starting in Beacon, New York, and then we go to New York City. So on July 31st, there's going to be a protest in New York City. Then we're going to Reading, Pennsylvania, and then on to Louisville, Kentucky. And some of the other stops are New Orleans, Houston, Texas. I think at Houston, Texas, we're going to be at least 15 caravans that are going to be hooking up and meeting with us. And, you know, every week there's more people who are signing up to do it. And on August 6th, we'll be arriving at McAllen, Texas, and we're going to do a 24-hour activities. We're going to be involved in helping the aid groups that are there. We really want this to be something where we're coming to help. We want people to get on board and to help these people and to bring everyone together, because this is a policy that the administration created. It didn't have to be like this. I'm sure it's costing lots of money to be housing these people and in these horrible conditions. We want all the families to be brought back together and to be treated humanely and with great respect.
And as grannies, you both have a significant experience, and you have world experience. You have experience living in this country. You've seen things that a lot of us haven't seen and haven't experienced. And Rafia, when you look at what's happening at the border, and when you look at these grannies like yourself getting involved, or abuelas getting involved in this, you know, from your historical perspective, where does this fall in terms of what you've seen in the United States? Where does this fall for you in terms of concern for our country and just what you're seeing the United States evolving into?
There's a familiarity to it, and there's a acknowledgement of this has happened before. It may not look like it's looking right now, but how we treat children in such an inhumane way, and the morality or the lack of morality, and how we treat children, how we disregard the effect of what we do, adults, has been consistent in this country, and particularly in the inner cities where I have lived all my life, D.C., and like I said, I've lived in Seattle. So what happens is when you aren't there, you can really look at it as an other. It's not me. It's not happening to me. And for me, knowing that it happens and knowing people that it's happened to, it's also a way of sometimes you just want to escape it. You don't want to feel it. You don't want to realize how horrible this thing is that's happening. So I have to really stay conscious and I have to really stay aware. And getting involved like this is such a real experience that's taking me to a very personal place. And I have to really work hard to keep my head together, not let my emotions run away, but to definitely stay in touch with them.
And something that we hear a lot about when it comes to protest movements, especially now, and I mean, this is not either of your first time at a protest movement. You've seen and experienced so many decades of American resistance. But one of the big things that's often focused on is youth, right? We hear a lot of people saying, get out there, young people, you can make the change. Is this a sort of call to those who may not be so youthful to get involved, grannies? Are you hoping that some of this protest is happening from elder Americans?
My hope is that there are people just like me. I mean, I just have been so horrified. And I think, you know, this is not the America that I know. I treat everyone with respect. People know me. I'm a big hugger. I hug everyone. And I think that we really, this is a bringing together of people. This is not something that should separate us. And I am just so excited that there are all these grannies, because I think, to think at our age, I'm 74 years old, and at this age, I can travel to Texas, and I can help and do things. And anyone else out there who wants to join us, please come join us.
As Michelle was saying, you just want to get connected, one person to another person to another person. I haven't quite become the mature age of 74, but I'm 10 years younger, so I'm on my way to you, Michelle. And I think we really will inspire and are inspiring people to realize I can do something, no matter what age, no matter what condition you're in. If something is important to you, you'll find a way to be a part of it. We've done it in the past. We'll keep doing it. That's one of the beautiful, resilient qualities of humanity. We will thrive. We will keep going forward.
Michelle Clifton and Rafia Jones with Grannies Respond, Abuelas Responden. Thank you both for being with us today. And we will keep track of what you guys are doing as you're out there on the road. So stay tuned.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show today. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.